Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the saber-rattling coming from Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, putting Iran on notice, which was followed by a tweet from Trump himself making the same vague threat. Abbas Milani, the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and co-author of Politics and Culture in Iran, Challenging the Status Quo, joins us to discuss the symbiosis between the hawks on both sides and how much Trump's threats play into the hands of the IRGC, Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, who got rich off the sanctions and are not happy with the nuclear deal that Trump also opposes. We will assess the consequences of a naval clash in the Persian Gulf that would likely close the Straits of Hormuz and cause a catastrophic rise in global oil prices, which would greatly benefit Trump's friend, Putin. Then, following today's national prayer breakfast, at which Donald Trump asked the attendees to pray for better ratings for Celebrity Apprentice, we'll examine the aggressive agenda of the religious right that Vice President Pence is enacting and the forthcoming White House executive order on so-called religious freedom. Matthew Sutton, distinguished professor of history at Washington State University and author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism, joins us to discuss how the new nominee to the Supreme Court is a part of a tectonic shift underway in American life, where the often fanatical beliefs of a religious minority will soon be imposed on the majority of citizens in the name of religious freedom. Then finally, we will look into the reality TV treatment Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull got from Donald Trump in last Saturday's call from the Oval Office, in which the leader of one of America's closest allies was informed by Trump that he had spoken with four other world leaders that day, including Russia's Putin, and quote, "This was the worst call so far," all but telling Turnbull, "You're fired," before hanging up on him. Toby Miller, a visiting professor at Tulane University and a regular contributor to Australia's national newspaper, The Australian, joins us to discuss the embarrassing antics of the most undignified and unhinged head of state in American history. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the board of directors of the University Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah, and his latest book is with Larry Diamond is Politics and Culture in Iran, Challenging the Status Quo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, this is a daily dose of extraordinary activity from the White House, so it's hard to keep up. But just go back a few days to the Muslim ban, which was aimed at seven countries, none of which have been the source of terrorist attacks on the United States. But very prominent among them, of course, was Iran. And very prominent in terms of an absence from the list was Saudi Arabia. But that notwithstanding, what struck me at the time was the utter absurdity of the, you know, here we have, for example, with the rapprochement with Cuba, the idea is to have as many now of the Cuban diaspora visit Havana and Cuba in order to influence the politics of the country and eventually ease it towards in a more democratic direction. So we one part of our foreign policy establishment seems to understand that. But that doesn't apply to Iran, where the Iranian diaspora, which I think would have the same effect, surely, on helping moderate Iran's policies, is now being banned. I mean, for example, would you be able to visit Iran?
Well, I can't visit Iran because I'm considered a critic of the Iranian regime, and I think they would not let me get back out. But I am Iranian-American. I have an American passport, and I could leave and come back to America freely, but I can't go to Iran. But I think your point is absolutely well taken. It's not just the Iranian diaspora that is, by and large, a force for moderation in Iran. I think the majority of Iranian society, and the book you kindly referred to, essentially makes that argument that the majority of Iranian society inside Iran also wants a more moderate, a more law-abiding, less aggressive Iran. And every time you have a jingoist narrative come out of the United States, every time you have the rumbles of war, the moderates in Iran are forced to either silence or forced to back the most radical elements of the regime, who have been pining to confront the United States, even during the Obama administration. So Iran, too, is in a very historically, I think, important moment of transition. And the kind of rhetoric that is coming out of the Trump administration is not only likely to lead to a very dangerous confrontation, but its damage will be even more long-term, because I think it will strengthen the hands of the radical, the lunatic fringes of Iranian politics that keep doing challenging things to see how far they can get away with, like sending boats to challenge U.S. naval forces in the region.
And, of course, on Wednesday, Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn, put Iran on notice over what he considered its destabilizing activity after a test fire of a ballistic missile. Now, the White House press secretary was not able to confirm what that meant, so we don't know what putting on notice means. Subsequent to that, the president himself has tweeted out a tweet saying Iran has been put, been formally put on notice again. Now, I must say that the Iranian response to it from Ali Akbar Velayati was, not that I'm in sympathy with these people at all, but he did say, this is not the first time that an inexperienced person has threatened Iran. The American government will understand that threatening Iran is useless. So how would you characterize that threat? Is it, I mean, you're making the point that in effect there's a kind of symbiosis here between the hawks on our side and the hawks in Iran, and they play into each other's hands, and the only people who are benefiting from this kind of bellicosity are the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and some of the lunatic fringes of Iranian politics, who have a monopoly grip on the economy and almost a monopoly grip on politics, and they want to keep that. And the way they think they can keep it is by constantly fueling the fire of confrontation with the United States. And now they have their perfect foil. You know, if the United States wants to put Iran on quote-unquote notice, there are many different ways of sending a message to Iran that from now on, don't send your boats near our warships. You can do it very discreetly. But for the National Security Advisor of the United States to come into a press conference and then make this announcement, and then have it followed by the president's comments, and today have it followed by the president's comment that all options are on the table. Within 24 hours, you have a ratcheting up of confrontational rhetoric that is absolutely unreasonable for what Iran has done. Iran has tested missiles. The UN thinks, the UN Secretary General thinks this is against the spirit of the agreement. No one except some conservatives have said that the agreement literally bans it. The agreement says we urge Iran not to do these things. I myself hope Iran will abide by that and not do these kinds of provocative things. I think many in Iran would hope that the radicals refrain from this kind of a lunatic challenging of the United States, of the international community. But we in the West, we in outside Iran have to be grown-ups. We have to recognize that there are elements within Iran who want a confrontation, who would benefit from that confrontation. And for the response to be a ratcheting up of the rhetoric and having the president's spokesperson, then his national security advisor, then the president himself, within 24 hours, making these kinds of threats is extremely dangerous, unless the administration thinks it wants to go to a military confrontation with Iran, which I think would be disastrous for Iran. It would be disastrous for U.S. allies in the region, and it would be disastrous for the United States. And no one, I think, will benefit from a military confrontation with Iran between the United States and Iran. It's going to engulf the region. And I don't think any reasonable person who has thought about this thinks a military confrontation, another war, is in the works. President Trump has repeatedly said it doesn't want to get the United States involved in another war in the Middle East. He has, I think, rightly criticized the war in Iraq. He has rightly criticized aspects of the war in Afghanistan. Forget about when he initially disagreed, but, you know, he's right. This was a grave mistake to go into Iraq the way the United States did. So he's not likely to make even a graver mistake and go into a country and confront a country that is three times the size of Iraq, has a military force that is very, very capable, that has, by some accounts, more than 100,000 missiles in Syria and in Lebanon, many of them directed towards Israel. It has the capacity to disrupt life in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia. Have they thought about all of these things when they make these kinds of bellicose rhetoric? The words of the President of the United States have to mean something and have to be calibrated to the danger at hand and have to be calibrated to what the United States plans to do. Suddenly, within 24 hours, they kept ratcheting it up in response to an event that the United States rightly considers a provocation. The generals, UN rightly considers a provocation. Europeans consider it a provocation. But there's a lot of disagreement whether this is a complete breach of what Iran has committed to. So in the grand scheme of things, it isn't like Iran has used a military threat against the United States. So it needs to have a response commensurate with the breach, and it needs to be coordinated with U.S. allies. The Trump administration wants to align itself with Russia. Forget about all the criticism, rightful criticism, I think, that people have, my colleague Mike McFaul has, of the fallacies of this policy. Russia is on a march. Russia is a threat to international security, but the president has a right to decide the foreign policy to a great extent. But if you're going to get close to Russia, if you're going to coordinate with Russia, Iran is right now one of the most important allies with Russia. Why are you picking a fight that you are not likely to have any impact other than creating tension here and sure. everywhere else?
Now, it's true that Russia and Iran are allies, but if you think this through in terms of the the logic behind the insanity, shall we say, any confrontation with Iran will result, I think, almost certainly with the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, and the oil supplies from the Persian Gulf will suddenly cease. And this will have a massive global effect on global economies. But more than anything else, I think it will reorder. The price of oil will go up like crazy. And that might well benefit Russia. And frankly, this is what's so strange about what we don't know what ties or leverage or blackmail Putin has over President Trump. There's something strange going on there. It's being investigated by the intelligence services here in the United States, who have already said that Putin ordered and authored the meddling in our elections. So that's an ongoing situation. When you think about the disconnect between General Flynn making these threats against Iran and almost provoking the IRGC to send out some boats to intercept an American destroyer, and then contrast that with the absolute silence from the Trump administration over Russia's ramping up the war in Ukraine by ramping up the attacks in eastern Ukraine against the Ukrainians through their proxies. So don't you find that extraordinary? I mean, you don't have to agree with my scenario, but there is a clear double standard here.
There is. I mean, if you think about the list of the... I mean, I'm against these kinds of bans. I am very much for rigorous vetting I'm very much for everyone who's listening to your program to know that Iranians coming to the United States who are now under ban and will be disproportionately hurt because there are 12,000 Iranian students in the United States, and all the other five countries that are in the ban put together don't have half that as many. But Iranians have already been going through an incredibly rigorous vetting process. That's why there hasn't been a single terrorist act by an Iranian in the United States since September 11. Even in Europe, agents of the Iranian regime that did engage in terrorist acts against Iranian opponents have now pulled back. But Chechens are probably one of the two greatest groups in ISIS. Tunisia is one of the greatest groups, I think, in ISIS. If you want to go after ISIS, put Russia on the list of banned countries. Put Tunisia on the list. Again, I want to reiterate, I don't favor these bans. I do favor rigorous vetting of anyone who comes in to make sure that ISIS affiliates don't come in. I'm not naive enough not to know that ISIS is trying to send in its agents into the West to engage in acts of violence and mayhem. But I also read the news, and most of the mayhem in the United States has been committed by people who were here long ago. And it has been very, very small. I mean, statistically, the number of the danger to the United States, to U.S. citizens, is very, very small. Again, the United States and the president have the right to defend the country, have the right to provide safety and security for the citizens, but they have to do it reasonably. They have to do it in a prudent manner. They have to go after the real threat, and they have to also think about the long-term impact of this. Anybody who has studied ISIS is, I think, of the opinion. I have never seen anyone disagree with this argument, that if ISIS is to be defeated, and ISIS is a cancer and needs to be defeated, I have no doubt about that. I gave a talk about this on Commonwealth Club a year and a half ago. So, I do believe that ISIS is a major threat, is a serious threat, and it needs to be defeated. But it ain't going to be defeated by U.S. bombing alone. It ain't going to be defeated by U.S. special forces. It ain't going to be defeated by simply creating safe zones in Syria with the help of Turkey and Saudi Arabia. ISIS will be defeated if the majority of the Muslims in the world who have nothing in common with ISIS ideology are mobilized to fight this, to fight it on the theological level, to fight it on an ideological level, to fight it on a practical level, to be convinced that if anyone is going in that direction, their community has to come and help them, save them from this evil. And if the community can't, work with the police to find a way out. Without that support, without that $1.5 billion, ISIS is not going to be defeated. Everybody knows that. You can't isolate your most important ally in the fight that you say you want to engage in. Europe is already distancing itself from this van because, they have a bigger problem. United States has 4 million Muslims. Europe has 40-odd million Muslims living there. They know an isolated, angry, alienated Muslim community can be a very serious threat. And you don't bring them into the liberal democratic fold, which is what we need to do if we're going to defeat this, by telling them you're not welcome here, even if you abide by all the laws and if you have been rigorously vetted and have been allowed to enter.
Well, just in closing, Abbas Milani, though, just because we've established that there's a symbiosis between the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who got rich off the sanctions and are very ambivalent about the deal made by the G5 plus one with Iran, the very deal that the White House, Trump has said was a terrible deal, and the Israelis want to overturn as well. Now you've got Flynn making threats to Iran. The possibility of the crazies being invited, in effect, to do something in the Straits of Hormuz is not, I think, something you can disregard. And I was just running through the consequences of that. If there's a clash in the Straits of Hormuz between the U.S. Navy and the IRGC, the Straits of Hormuz will be closed, the price of oil will go through the roof, and that will benefit Russia. Isn't that logical?
And Iran, which is a major exporter of oil. Remember, Iran's Mr. Trump rightly says that Iran was facing a lot of economic difficulties before the nuclear deal. He's right about that. He's wrong when he says $150 billion was given to them. The $150 billion was owed to Iran. Only $50 billion of it has gone back to Iran. He's right that some of the most radical elements of the regime have gotten their hand on most of that money. But he's wrong in thinking that confronting Iran is going to hurt the economy and bring them back to the negotiating table. Increased price of oil will increase Iran's oil revenues, which they desperately need.
But how will they get it out of the Gulf?
Well, you know, the Gulf is not the only country that buys oil from Iran. They have been selling oil to some of the. They've been selling oil and gas to Turkey. They've been selling oil and gas to Kurdistan. They've been selling oil and gas to some of the Central Asia. They can send oil and gas through a gas pipeline. They try. They're very desperately trying to build it to go to. China is building a major base on Iranian territory that just juts out into the Indian Ocean. It's possible to get it out there. And we're talking only about Iran and another big elephant in the room, which Mr. Trump has put on a kind of a conflicted pattern, U.S. relations with it, is China. What China is going to do. China is not going to sit idly by and allow to be pushed around. So we need to, I hope you can get some China expert to talk about, you know, what China policy is going to be, what China advisors to Mr. Trump think. Mr. Pillsbury, who has written about what he thinks is a 100-year secret Chinese plan to dominate the world. Mr. Bannon, who has said that, you know, we are on a confrontation path with China. These things bode ill for the future of the world, not just America.
Well, Abbas Milani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
That's a pleasure, as always, chatting with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Abbas Milani. He's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center for International Relations. His latest book with Larry Diamond is Politics and Culture in Iran, Challenging the Status Quo. We can take a brief station break. We're back examining the aggressive agenda of the religious right that Vice President Pence is enacting.
Strikes now, so it would strike in me.
Well, I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my blessed Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through all trials and tribulations and my travels through the nations with my blessed Jesus I'll go far. Oh, blessed Jesus.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Sutton, who is the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Sutton.
Hi, Ian. Good to be back on.
Thanks for joining us, Matthew. And what do you make of the prayer breakfast remarks, or the remarks at the prayer breakfast today that Donald Trump made? First of all, he was introduced by Mark Burnett, a English producer, very successful in reality TV, married to this Irish actress who did Touched by an Angel. They both wear their religion on their sleeves. And, of course, to Mark Burnett, they did Trump in a massive favor because he refused to release all of the outtakes from The Apprentice that apparently people on the show had said showed Trump behaving in an appalling manner, even worse than the Access Hollywood tape revealed. So there's a political connection there to this good Christian and his relationship with Donald Trump, the thrice-divorced libertine, owner of gambling dens, yet now the champion of religious freedom and the religious right.
It is. The whole thing is surreal. And once again, as people keep talking about, it's, you know, reality TV come to the White House. But what struck me was the fact that Trump once again made something that really wasn't supposed to be about him all about him. And the prayer breakfast has been around for 60 years, and it really is an opportunity for political leaders to come and speak and talk about the nation and talk about the American people. And it's really not supposed to be about a particular celebrity putting himself up at the forefront, but of course we should have expected that that's exactly what Trump would do.
Well, not only that, he attacked another celebrity, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and asked the people there at the prayer breakfast to pray for Arnold to get his ratings back up. And, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger responded by saying, Arnold is praying that President Trump can start improving his own approval ratings, which were the worst in history for an incoming president, by taking his job seriously and working inclusively. So the battle of the titans there, I guess. But in general, though, what's scary is, in the context of this new nominee for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, who his only book that he wrote is about his religious beliefs that there should be no death with dignity, end of life. In other words, people have to die in agony because this man's personal religious beliefs trump their own personal agony and suffering at the end of life. And he did the same thing with the Hobby Lobby decision, where he favored an employer who didn't want to give contraceptive coverage to his employees, where the employer's rights of his religious freedom trump, if that's the way it, if I can use that,
right,
trump the employee's personal rights to get contraception. So here you have the inherent double standard. And it's the same thing with the abortion argument, that the proponents against abortion basically feel that they're right, they have more right over somebody else's womb than the person who's actually carrying the baby, and that it's their right to decide what that woman does with that fetus is trumps again the person who's actually carrying the child. And that's inherently what's at stake here in the United States, and apparently now it is pretty clear in the new White House draft of the executive order on religious freedom that's coming out soon that will further take us down that path. So I see this Supreme Court nominee being a part of this religious freedom juggernaut, you know, and I use the word religious freedom with some irony.
Right, yeah, no doubt about that. I'm not sure. On the Supreme Court nominee issue, I'm a little bit hopeful because he goes to apparently a pretty progressive, pretty liberal Episcopal church in Boulder, Colorado, with a woman rector, a church that has advocated for gun rights, that has advocated for freedom for the LGBT community. So, you know, it may be that his wife drags him to church and he just kind of ignores it, but it may actually be that I'm hoping, I probably shouldn't say this on radio, but I'm hoping he's more progressive than the Trump people realize. Certainly I could be wrong, but, you know, on a day of the prayer breakfast, I'll have a little faith that things will be a little better than what they look now. But on the issue of the prayer breakfast itself, what struck me back to Schwarzenegger, you know, was the fact that he opened his comments by making a joke about prayer. And, you know, that may work in a comedy club, or that may be work at a national correspondence dinner, but to actually go up among a bunch of leading clergymen, and the first thing you do is talk sarcastically about the power of prayer, that you're going to pray for Schwarzenegger's ratings on The Apprentice. This struck me as, once again, ironic, but also hitting exactly the wrong tone. I mean, the guy is incredibly tone deaf. And what I'm waiting for somebody to stand up and tell him that. I was looking back, and in 1973, Mark Hatfield, the Republican senator from Oregon, stood up to Richard Nixon at the prayer breakfast because he didn't think Nixon should be using the prayer breakfast to promote himself or his policies, and especially his policy in Vietnam. And Hatfield really denounced Nixon and infuriated Nixon, but there's nobody yet in the Republican Party who seems willing to do that. They're all just rolling over and letting Trump co-opt their religion, which, as you pointed out, he has little faith in. It's not a part of his life, and yet when he uses these words, they just sit there and applaud instead of calling him for the crap that it is.
Well, it's obviously the deal was done. Trump, the art of the deal, he made a deal. We'll take Mike Pence as my vice president, and as long as I get the Christian right's votes. And it seems to be even going further now, where the Christian right is going to be, whether or not they're behind this choice of the Supreme Court nominee, they're certainly behind this new religious freedom executive order that's coming out. And my sense is that this is what's troubling. We know who Trump is. It's just the lack of conscience on the part of the Republicans to take any kind of moral stand. The fact that he's delivered power to them, particularly Mike Pence, that seems to be all they care about. And they're hitting the ground running. And by the way, Gorsuch may be going to this progressive church, but he did write that book about his, opposition to death with dignity. And frankly, there's a very moving letter from somebody in California in the New York Times today who's dying from stage 4 cancer, just saying, I'm supposed to die in agony just because this guy has these moral beliefs that he wants to impose on the rest of us.
Sure. No, and there's no doubt that that's troubling. And it'll be interesting to see if he believes that the law supports that position or if he was making that as sort of a personal position and how he's able to separate those two things. But on the issue of Trump in using the prayer breakfast, the other thing that struck me from the speech was the way he used it to kind of justify, to claim that this is a nation of religious freedom and religious tolerance, coming just days after he shut off, Muslims from 7 different countries from returning to the United States. And again, to your point, the irony that the Republicans are just accepting this, that nobody is calling him on this, and the religious leaders are willing to work with this administration. And, conservative Protestants, evangelicals, since World War II have been some of the leaders at dealing with refugees. And, of course, it's because they want to convert them, but they want to bring them here so they can convert them. And so Trump is really putting a wrinkle into their plans, but apparently they're willing to make this deal with the devil to get access to Trump. They're going to just support whatever he wants to do.
Well, prior to this prayer breakfast, 800 church leaders around the country did sign a letter. One of them, of course, is Sister Simone Campbell, who I've interviewed a few times. And she said, there is nothing Christian about Trump's ban on refugees from Muslim countries, denigration of immigrants, and repeal of pro-life health care. I call on President Trump to put his Christian values into practice. And then the letter said, a troubled conscience is one hallmark of a great leader. A conscience that is not awake to suffering and fails to respond is walled off from the love of God. And it is pretty hard to live with the knowledge that the President of the United States the people around him are leaking like crazy. Anybody who spends any time close to this man just are troubled by him. And of course, we on the program today, we're also talking about his trashing the Prime Minister of Australia. At some point or other, I guess I just get back to what I was saying earlier, Matthew, is that I just really find these Christian leaders that support Trump and were there cheering him on and laughing at his jokes today at the prayer breakfast, at what point are they going to show some Christian compassion?
No, and you're exactly right to ask that question. I've wondered the same thing. I've spent the last 10 years studying these folks, and I always gave them the benefit of the doubt. I always believed that they really had the greater good for the country in mind, that their policies, their political positions, that even though I might disagree with them, I thought that we all agreed that we were trying to do what was best for the country. And now I'm just, I've been stunned for the last 6 months. I don't know how to make sense of this. And the only conclusion I can come to is that they are, you know, xenophobic, nativist, racist, sexist, fearmongers who are interested in essentially power and power at any cost. Because I don't know what other conclusion I can draw from these people who are cozying up to Donald Trump than that one.
Well, it feels like Judas and the 30 pieces of silver, doesn't it? I mean, they're just bought off by, not directly bribed, but bribed by power. And that's what Mike Pence is all about. And by the way, in your 10 years or so dealing with these people and trying to figure out what makes them tick, how do they, for example, Mike Pence, again, wears his religion on his sleeves in an extremely aggressive way. He was the governor of Indiana. One of his signature achievements in Indiana was to make it a right-to-work state and to basically prevent unions from operating in the state. And we all know that unionized workers have better benefits, better wages, and have a better life. So where is the moral justification for diminishing the standard of living of the people in your state? What's Christian about that?
Yeah, no, and I think they would disagree with your characterization of unions. They would see them as corrupt, as too powerful, and as supporting, you know, the Democratic Party. And so for all those reasons, they would oppose it. But I think you're right. There is a lack of a sensibility to social justice issues and economic issues. And that's been true from mainstream evangelicalism for a long time. There have always been American evangelicals on the political left who are more aware of these issues, but the mainstream has not been. They've been so focused on the moral issues. And really, that's the genius of the Jerry Falwells and the James Dobsons and the Phyllis Schlafly's, is they've gotten us so distracted by these kind of moral issues, euthanasia, abortion, same-sex marriage, that we are completely oblivious to what's happening in terms of bread and butter, what's happening in people's homes, what's happening in terms of their basic healthcare and economic kinds of concerns. And so, it's a problem. And I think there are some thoughtful evangelicals who are wrestling with it and dealing with it. But what we're seeing from the polls and from the voting returns is certainly not enough of them are wrestling with these issues.
Well, so many of these cabinet choices are clearly unqualified, and there's a real bottom-feeding nature to it. And the worst of all, of course, is the nominee to be the head of the Department of Education, who wants to destroy public schools and put everybody on vouchers. And her kids went to religious schools, and she's one of, again, a very sort of aggressive evangelical herself. But you mentioned Jerry Falwell. We learned today that Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, who campaigned with Donald Trump, is going to lead the Trump administration's task force charged with deregulating higher education, and in particular, deregulating these crooked for-profit colleges, these predatory colleges, all of which operate entirely on government funds, where they con vets and young aspirants to education and a middle-class life with these worthless diplomas and saddle them with a lifetime of debt. And it's a bipartisan racket. It costs the taxpayer about $40 billion a year. It's been going on for some time. Obama did not really crack down on it, although he did bring in a rule that showed that they had to have some results. They had to show that their graduates actually got jobs, which none of them do. And guess what's happened? Falwell has been put in charge with rolling back these requirements under the Trump administration's, which Falwell Jr. said in an interview to the Chronicle of Higher Education that his focus will be on rolling back a series of initiatives that the Obama administration viewed as preventing abuses by these predatory for-profit colleges. And Jerry Falwell Jr. says, "My goal is to pare it back and give colleges and their accrediting agencies more leeway in governing their affairs." Now, and we know that Betsy DeVos also in her confirmation hearings refused to say that she would not get rid of this rule that Obama put in to make these people accountable as they rip off the taxpayer and destroy the lives of young Americans. So I guess I shouldn't be too surprised that the man behind Trump University is putting this guy in who runs one of these for-profit universities. Jerry Falwell Jr. runs Liberty University.
Well, my understanding is that Liberty is a nonprofit because it is a religiously affiliated private school, but it has a huge online presence that generates a lot of revenue, but it's not paying out dividends to any, you know, to any board of directors or anything. It just goes back into the church and the ministry and the university. But yeah, what's astonishing about this is that Trump, if we take him at his word and all of his talk about, you know, getting rid of government waste, of getting rid of the bureaucracy, that this seems to go against that, because essentially what he's saying is that students should be able to take government money and throw it away on, you know, these for-profit, diploma mill, you know, jokes of universities. And that's an absolutely unwise use of taxpayer money. I mean, there's nobody in this country who should be supporting that, Republican or Democrat. And so as I've tried to make sense of it, the only thing I can see is exactly what you alluded to earlier, that this is about Trump University. He's pissed off that he was embarrassed by the scam that was Trump University. And so what's he going to do? He's going to tear down the entire house of higher education by putting somebody like Jerry Falwell in charge. But it just makes no sense in any sense, not in a partisan sense, not in an economic sense, not even really in an ideological sense, for the government to be giving people loans for fake degrees. It just doesn't compute, unless Trump has some ulterior motive, which is to stick it to higher education in general.
Well, just to touch on Liberty University's government funding, in 2015, Liberty University received $347 million from federal undergraduate grant and loan programs, which is very few other nonprofit colleges receive anything like that sum. The University of Virginia, which is a very well-regarded university, only received $37 million from the same source that year. And Liberty has built up a $1 billion cash reserve, and Mr. Falwell is paid more than $900,000 a year. And incidentally, the most recent addition to the campus of Liberty University was to put in a firing range where people, students can shoot their assault rifles. So,
yeah. Well, you know, his salary, $900,000, is not much more than public university presidents make with much smaller enrollments than he has, which is, you know, not to justify what he's doing, but he also has more online students than anybody except the University of Phoenix. So, you know, so I think the problem is his ideas and his beliefs and his ideology. It's not his salary or the amount of student loans that are coming in there, because that's a reflection of how many students he's been able to attract, which is also a reflection of the problem we have in higher education in this country, that people would rather take classes at Liberty University than at the University of Virginia. And that's a problem we need to think about.
Well, it does feel like the floodgates of scam artists have been opened. And I thank you for joining us, Matthew Sutton.
Thank you, Ian. It's always fun to be with you.
Thank you. I wish it was a fun topic, but thanks again. And I've been speaking with Matthew Sutton, who's the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the reality TV treatment Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull got from Donald Trump in last Saturday's call from the Oval Office. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Toby Miller, who's a visiting professor of Latin American Studies at Tulane University in New Orleans, one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and he is a regular contributor to The Australian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And Australia is in an uproar. Its closest ally, the United States, the President of the United States, has dissed the Australian Prime Minister and treated him like a contestant on The Apprentice. You know, he didn't exactly say you're fired, But he had a phone call in this flurry of phone calls last Saturday that Trump had from the Oval Office. And after sort of badgering Malcolm Turnbull and bragging about Trump's imaginary huge win in the election, he went on to tell Turnbull that he had spoken with four other world leaders that day, including Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, and this is the worst call so far. Here he is basically grading these world leaders according to his Trump meter. So I don't know where to start. This whole thing's crazy. And of course, just yesterday we talked about how Bannon has taken over the White House and there's no paper trail. And they already sanitized the transcripts, but some brave soul in the White House got the real transcripts of this phone call to the Washington Post, along with, by the way, the transcript of the call to the Mexican president, Peña Nieto, in which Trump threatened to send troops into Mexico to get rid of bad hombres. So let's start with the Australian situation.
As you say, we feel as though we're in the unraveling of an extremely disturbed person. And, of course, that means not only an extremely disturbed United States, but an extremely disturbed world. Let's give this some trans-Pacific context. So Australia is in a treaty with the United States, a military treaty that was signed in 1950 that also involves New Zealand / Aotearoa, called the ANZUS Treaty. And rather like NATO, the ANZUS Treaty says that an attack on one will be considered an attack on all. And like a good lapdog, Australia has leapt into action alongside the United States in Korea, in Vietnam, in Iraq twice, and anywhere that it's called upon to do so. In fact, when the Pentagon Papers were leaked in the early 70s, they disclosed that the United States hadn't even requested Australian participation in Vietnam. The Australians had insisted that they do so. And very famously, in the 1966 election, Harold Holt, who was the Australian Prime Minister of the day, coined the slogan, "All the way with LBJ," referring to Lyndon Baines Johnson, the then president. And, of course, LBJ came to Australia during the election campaign. Quite unprecedented. That said, although there is this treaty, in 1969, Richard Milhouse Nixon, remember Richard Nixon? We thought he was a bad president once, Ian.
Yeah, right.
Richard Milhouse Nixon enunciated the Guam Doctrine. And the Guam Doctrine says that any military alliance that the United States is involved in, be it technically legal or not in the form of a treaty, will only see the United States participate in military activities in its own interests. This was a real shock to the New Zealanders and the Australians, as they really thought, especially after participating in Vietnam, that if the Chinese or the Indonesians, their principal fears, were to invade them, then the U.S. would come to their aid. And basically, Nixon said, well, not necessarily. Successive U.S. presidents have not shifted from the Guam Doctrine. And in addition to that, Australia has been a place for some of the most sophisticated and expensive spying surveillance technology the United States has, due to its relatively unpolluted air in the desert and its excellent satellite connections. And yet many of these facilities have been kept secret largely from the Australian public and even for decades from the Australian government. So the long-term backdrop to this is a supine relationship between a country that basically was a kind of wannabe America. And the short-term history, which is about Malcolm Turnbull, its current prime minister, is this. Late last year, the Obama people were trying to do something about a very, very complex refugee problem that they were managing along with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and the International Organization for Migration, namely what to do about many people fleeing for their lives from Honduras, from Guatemala, from El Salvador, and who had found their way to Costa Rica. These people weren't technically refugees in that they were not fleeing state administrations that were inimical to their survival. Instead, they were fleeing organized gang violence. And basically, the Obama people held a big summit meeting. Turnbull was one of the participants to try to find places for these folks to go. And of course, in terms of the U.S. anxiety about these people, much of the moral panic about Latino so-called gangs in Southern California in particular, is about people reuniting from El Salvador, from Honduras, and so on, and becoming gangbangers. And the Australians were there because they had two items on their agenda. The first was, as usual, suck up to D.C., and the second was reasonably large numbers of real refugees, i.e. refugees from state persecution, from the Arab world, were arriving on Australian shores. Australia has, of course, a massive coastline, much bigger than the United States. And unlike the United States, it is a very sparsely populated country. It's very, very difficult to police those borders. The Australian government, which is as racist as the US government, has a policy of not accepting any maritime refugees, which it refers to brutally as boat people. And so it's taken numerous refugees from wars in which it's participated, like Iraq, but also from Syria, and put them into other Pacific Ocean places. So Papua New Guinea is one, a former Australian colony, which has been independent since 1975, and Nauru is another. So what the Australians cut a deal with Obama on was the idea that the Australians would take like 1,200 refugees from Costa Rica who were nationals of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and so on, and in return, the United States would take these folks who were in Papua New Guinea and Nauru, who were from the Arab world, as refugees. And that's the thing that Turnbull wants Trump to honor, and now Trump is making a fuss about.
Well, he made more than a fuss. He accused Turnbull of saying this is going to be like the Boston bombers we're letting in. And then subsequent to him hanging up on the Australian Prime Minister on a call on Saturday, Trump tweeted that, "Do you believe it? The Obama administration agreed to take thousands of illegal immigrants from Australia. Why? I will study this dumb deal." Well, it wasn't thousands. It was 1,250. But Trump is just amazing how little regard he has for the facts and how hyperbole is second nature to him. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the backlash. You're in touch with Australia. I know that here in the United States, Senator John McCain called the Australian ambassador in Washington to essentially apologize and to remind the Australians that America appreciates the sacrifices that you've just mentioned, how they're almost all too willing to step up and die for the American cause. But of course, the Americans saved them during World War II from the Japanese. So that's a pretty big favor they owe them, wouldn't you say?
To a certain extent, I agree, Ian, but there are complications. I used to act as a consultant to U.S. corporations who were sending executives and their families to Australia for 2 to 3 year stints, and I would do a kind of cultural indoctrination. One of the things I taught them about was something called the Brisbane Line. Now, you would have grown up probably hearing about the Brisbane Line. This is the line that the Australian government and Washington drew that said that basically the top third of Australia would be sacrificed to the Japanese. But the Americans weren't prepared to commit enough men, and it was almost all men, to hold the top third of Australia. And so a vast amount of the Australian population, the whole state of Queensland, for example, has never really trusted the U.S. because this mythic Brisbane line, which it turned out some years ago to be real, is a sign that, yes, we were saved by them, but no, they weren't going to save all of us. And then the other expression, which was used about GIs during the war, was overpaid, oversexed, and over here. So there's always been an ambivalence, even as there is without a doubt a dependence or reliance. But getting back to Trump, I think one of the reasons why the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, these bastions of the liberal establishment, have become so vicious, and rightly so, of course, and so distracted and so perturbed, is not only that they signally failed to do their jobs during the Republican primaries and afterwards, but also because one of the things that Trump lacks, that even Nixon had, and certainly the Bushes had, and Obama, and even Clinton at the height of his depredations, was dignity. And one of the elements that Trump misses very seriously is recognizing that the U.S. political system is unusual in that the chief elected official and top politician of the country is also the head of state. And the head of state is meant to conduct her or himself with dignity, with gravitas, and not only to be the mudslinging, head-kicking figure of American capitalism or gutter politics or old-fashioned broadsheet or tabloid journalism. And it's that lack of dignity that he is demonstrating, as per his conversations with Malcolm Turnbull, that is, I think, deeply unsettling to traditionalists of all stripes, whether it's Arthur Sulzberger or it's John McCain.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Toby Miller, I mean, you cannot defend the Australian immigration policy. I mean, you'd think that these two guys would get on like a house on fire because and Turnbull is hanging by a thread. He's only got a one-seat majority in the parliament, and Trump is not, you know, hardly a legitimately elected president. There's a cloud of Russian involvement hanging over his head in the elections, etc. And furthermore, Trump wants to build a wall to shut the Mexicans out, and Turnbull has shut the boat people out, as he calls them, and dumped them on these Pacific islands.
You're absolutely right, Ian. In a sense, the human lives we're describing, whether these be human lives from Syria, Iraq, Honduras, or El Salvador, are people on a chessboard, and they have no agency. They're allotted no decency. Their human rights are to be distributed as if they really were pawns. And this is as true of what the Obama administration did as it is true of Turnbull, as it is true of Trump. Individual agency, individual decency, and basic respect for the lives of others is meaningless to these people. They're operating with the lives of innocent refugees from horrendous state and gang violence as playing cards, as chips, and little else. And that lack of humanity is what will ultimately undo the man we should now be calling Tiberius.
Well, I think you might even be dignifying Tiberius, because this guy, he's a little out to lunch. I mean, he's just completely out of control, out of his depth, and he's pulling off a massive con, and he may well get away with it unless the real nature of who he is and what he does all day can be exposed, and you have to be grateful for the amount of leakers that are happening in the White House. But just in closing, in the last minute, is there a way forward for U.S.-Australian relations here, given their close historic alliance?
Well, ANZUS still matters. The U.S. fleet is regularly in Australian ports. There are many joint military exercises. Australia does both illegal and legal things in many of the Arab world battles that the United States has created for itself and others. Trade is very important. The Australians were very keen on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, sank into the water somewhere across the Pacific under Obama and isn't likely to be resuscitated under Trump. Australians have a massive affinity for U.S. popular culture and U.S. life, but there is no doubt that on a bipartisan basis, right across the political spectrum, Trump will have absolutely zero credit in Australian public life for the rest of the administration.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a visiting professor in Latin American Studies at Tulane University in New Orleans. He is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And he's a regular contributor to the major national newspaper in Australia, The Australian. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.